Einstein, relativity, and relative ethics. Does God play dice with the universe? By Donald Harvey Marx. This is Donald Marx. With all the uncertainty and turmoil in our lives, many have wondered whether there is meaning to the world and whether God truly plays dice with the universe. In many ways, Einstein and his findings of relativity can help us answer these questions. This presentation on Einstein, relativity, and relative ethics discusses the early history of Einstein's life and his key concepts, where they fit into history, and then addresses whether some or all ethical decisions have moral absolutes or are simply relative to their context. Emphasis is given to decisions made in medicine and public health, and the consequences of relative ethics are explored. This article is also available for your reading pleasure on my personal blog, dhmarks.blogspot.com, and also on the website Medium and on my LinkedIn account. And now the article, Einstein, Relativity and Relative Ethics, whatever. Einstein, Relativity, and Relative Ethics by Donald Marx. With all the uncertainty and turmoil in our lives, many have wondered whether there is meaning in the world and whether God truly does play dice with the universe. In many ways, Einstein and his findings of relativity can help us answer this question. This is Donald Marx, and today, in a number of parts, I will be discussing this question of whether God plays dice with the universe and whether there really is situational ethics or absolute ethics. Let's first talk about Einstein, the person. Albert Einstein was born on March 14, 1879 in Ulm, Germany, and he died in 1955. He was a brilliant scientist who thought outside the box. The phrase, "All things are relative," is often attributed to him, but Einstein never said that, nor did he mean that. Einstein originated the concepts which led to the atomic bomb. He was a German, a Jew, and an atheist. He was a man uncertain with his scientific findings and self-aware of his fallibility. Einstein was a mere mortal, a husband, a divorcee, a father, and a grandfather. He was a funny-looking guy with messy hair who almost never wore socks. When Einstein quit school at the age of 15, his teacher claimed there was nothing left to teach him. At 17, Einstein applied for admission to the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology. He passed the math and science sections of the entrance exam, but failed the rest, such as history, languages, geography. His scope of knowledge was relatively intense in math and physics, but very restrictive otherwise. As Einstein said, knowledge is limited, but imagination circles the world. Einstein had to go to a trade school in 1896 before he retook the exam and was finally admitted to the Swiss Institute a year later. During that time, he often missed classes and preferred reading about physics and playing his violin. To the public, Einstein presented himself as being a humble man, but said of himself, "I have no special gift. I am only passionately curious." Although he may have been sincere when he said this, Einstein was not known for his humility or his understanding of his fellow humans. At the turn of the 19th century, the world was changing rapidly with many scientific achievements. In 1901, Guglielmo Marconi developed a radio system and could transmit Morse code over the Atlantic Ocean. In 1903, Henry Ford produced the Model A car, and the Wright brothers made their first flight. Around this time, Einstein took a job as an examiner at the patent office in Bern, Switzerland, which provided him with financial security while in grad school and an opportunity to hone his analytic skills. some 3 centuries earlier, in 1564 to 1642, Galileo's principle of relativity has stated that all uniform motion was relative and that there was no absolute and well-defined state of rest. We are all familiar watching a person on the deck of a ship which is passing by us. To the person on the ship's deck, he may be at rest, in his opinion, but from the view of somebody observing him from the shore, he appears to be moving. His movement is relative to the observer. In his special theory of relativity, Einstein in 1905 expanded the understanding of relative motion of Galileo into a more general principle of relativity, which included many laws of nature. Einstein called his theory special because it did not discuss gravity, which he addressed later in the general theory of relativity. As Einstein said, everything should be made as simple as possible, but not simpler. Special relativity makes some qualities and quantities, such as time, relative, that we would have imagined to be absolute based on our everyday experience. It also makes absolute other qualities and quantities, like the speed of light, that we would have thought to be relative. Is this true for ethics also? The speed of light, 186,000 miles per second, is a universal constant, a property of the physical universe, absolute, immutable, but whose very property is counterintuitive. The special theory of relativity does not prohibit faster-than-light motion, and just within the last few years, we have detected evidence of particles that travel faster than light. As it is, light traveling 2.5 years could reach the nearest star, and 179,000 years to the nearest galaxy. Of course, at the time of the special theory of relativity, scientists knew of only one galaxy in the universe, our galaxy, the Milky Way. Einstein joked, "Put your hand on a hot stove for a minute, and it seems like an hour. Sit with a pretty girl for an hour, and it seems like a minute. That's relativity." Einstein reasoned that small amounts of mass may be converted into a very large amount of energy and vice versa. This is because Einstein saw mass and energy as different manifestations of the same thing, as pointed out in his famous equation, E equals mc squared. Commenting on the pairing of mass and energy, Einstein said, "This thought is amusing and infectious, but I cannot possibly know whether the good Lord does not laugh at it and has led me up the garden path." In 1915, Einstein revealed his theory of general relativity, which predicted that gravity is a property of curved space and time, and thus curvature of space-time is produced by the mass itself. Up to this point, Einstein's theories had not been demonstrated to be true. They were not proven or validated in any scientific sense. And so, in an address to the French Philosophical Society at the Sorbonne on April 6, 1922, Einstein said, "If my theory of relativity is proven successful, Germany will claim me as a German, and France will declare that I am a citizen of the world. Should my theory prove untrue, France will say that I am a German, and Germany will declare that I am a Jew." In 1919 to 1922, the German, Russian, and Turk Ottoman empires collapsed. That year, Einstein's mother died. He divorced his wife, Melva Marek Einstein, and he remarried 5 months later to the widow, Elsa Einstein, who was a relative. In 1921, Einstein was awarded the Nobel Prize in Physics for his work on the photoelectric effect, not for relativity. Although Jews represent only 0.1% of the world's people, they have earned 22 to 36% of Nobel laureates. In 1925, Edwin Hubble, who is the namesake for the Hubble telescope, discovered that galaxies other than our Milky Way galaxy exist within our universe. We now know that there are 250 plus billion galaxies. Our own galaxy is thought to contain 100 billion stars. 7 years after this discovery, in 1932, Cockcroft and Walton demonstrated experimentally that mass and energy are equivalent, the first experimental validation of Einstein's theories. Einstein, Relativity, and Relative Ethics by Donald Marx. Part 2, Einstein's Great Mistakes. Einstein disliked uncertainty, but he was plagued by it his entire professional life. Much in science is unknowable, and his most important equations did not work unless he added fudge factors called constants to fix things. Einstein developed the idea of a cosmologic constant, which he thought shortly thereafter to have been a terrible mistake, but which turns out not to have been a mistake at all. How many times have we made what we think is a wrong decision, but which turns out to be the right ones? How many times have we tried to fix things by adding something to the mix? Candy for a tearful child, the keys to the car to a pestering adolescent, ignoring signs of the dependency in a loved one. The right way may not be absolutely knowable, but I often think we can sense it. Einstein signed a letter to President Roosevelt recommending that atom bombs be made. Years later, he lamented this move, but at the time, it was certainly the best decision possible relative to the evil that would have persisted otherwise. To agonize over past decisions and their consequences is a common malady. Einstein said, "The release of atom power has changed everything except our way of thinking. The solution to this problem lies in the heart of mankind. If only I had known, I should have become a watchmaker." Einstein did not develop his interpersonal side. In fact, Einstein said, "My passionate sense of social justice and social responsibility has always contrasted oddly with my pronounced lack of need for direct contact with other human beings and human communities. I am truly a lone traveler and have never belonged to my country, my friends, my home, or even my immediate family with my whole heart. In the face of all these ties, I have never lost a sense of distance and a need for solitude. I find it so hard to understand how one could be passionate for social justice and still remain a lone traveler. I don't think that Einstein even knew himself. Certainly, his lamentations smack of insincerity and regret. People use Einstein for his capabilities as a theoretical physicist, not because of his ability to transform his ideas into practice. He was valued as a spokesperson for causes, and often he was quoted, but his influence outside of physics was probably relatively small. People with remarkable talents are often boxed into their specific areas by society and by themselves. As a philosophical point, Einstein did not think that all things are relative. Einstein did believe that all things are knowable, not mysterious or left to chance like the roll of dice. I, for one, am not at all convinced that all things that really count are relative. Heisenberg, another great physicist and a contemporary of Einstein, developed what is commonly referred to as the uncertainty principle. Heisenberg proposed that one cannot simultaneously know the mass and the position of a particle. I think that this is more of a technical issue than a basic law of nature, but as a concept, uncertainty was absolutely unacceptable to Einstein. Einstein was an absolutist in many things. He said, It is hard to sneak a look at God's cards, but that there should be statistical laws with indefinite solutions, laws that compel God to throw dice in each individual case, I find highly disagreeable. I too strongly disagree with the uncertainty principle, but for different reasons, both in physics and as applied to interpersonal relationships. How does this all relate to us as individuals and to our own interpersonal affairs? Perhaps the uncertainty principle means that sometimes the correct moral and ethical choices really are relative and uncertain. Uncertainty and ethical decisions can lead directly to situational ethics, commonly known as whatever. Does God play dice with the universe? I think not. Not all can be known, but important things can be known. Einstein accepted a position teaching at Princeton in the 1930s. Carved into the mantelpiece in the old fine hall is the German saying, Raffiniert ist der Herrgott, aber beschafft er ist nicht. Translated, this reads, shrewd is the Lord, but malicious he is not. Perhaps it is true that very little said has not been said before, for Psalms 18 reads, to the faithful you show yourself faithful, to the blameless you show yourself blameless, to the pure you show yourself pure, but to the crooked you show yourself shrewd. There was little doubt that Einstein had seen this German phrase and that he had read Psalm 18. What does this Psalm 18 mean? First, it means that we were made in God's image. However, we see God as a creator, as a universal force of love, or in a more classic sense. To me, Psalm 18 means that we should see ourselves as a part of nature in God and God in ourselves. When viewed in the sense of universality of life and of God as a life force, this is entirely consistent with modern ethical principles. Second, God reflects ourselves, and we can see our reflection in God. Third, no one can fool God, but we can certainly fool ourselves and those we care about most, at least for some relative amount of time. God, our universal spirit, knows our heart, and is revealed to us as required. Great peace can come from harmonizing our lives and our ethics with the rhythm and flow of the universal spirit. There are many things which Einstein was not aware of. Although he told us that his knowledge was limited, his hubris seems insincere and for public consumption. I don't think that he seriously considered how reliance on scientific principles truly limited his knowledge of the universe. Einstein did not know of the existence of many things which he could not see, touch, or measure, and yet which exerted huge powers in his life. Dark matter and dark energy, which may constitute 90% of the universe and hold it together. Galaxies, in addition to the Milky Way. String theory, cell phones, computers, transistors, transplantation, DNA, the internet, and social networking media. All these things were unknown to Einstein. Physics defines four forces in nature: strong, weak, electromagnetic, and gravitational. Einstein never knew that love, forgiveness, pride, and the spirit of life are also very strong and very important forces. This is Donald Marks, and I'm continuing part three of my discussion of Einstein, relativity, and relative ethics. But what does this have to do with us as individuals? Moral relativism holds that moral decisions are relative to the social, cultural, historical, or personal circumstances surrounding each situation and don't represent universal truths. Moral relativism claims that no universal standard exists by which to assess an ethical proposition's truth. Moral relative values are applicable only within certain cultural boundaries or in the context of individual preferences. An extreme relativistic position might even suggest that judging the moral or ethical decisions or acts of another person or group has no absolute meaning at all. But as I will show, there are absolute moral rights and wrongs without which society will simply collapse, as did Soviet Russia, China during the Cultural Revolution, and Cambodia during Pol Pot. Some moral relativists hold that a personal and subjective moral core lies at the foundation of an individual's moral acts. In this view, public morality reflects social convention. In this mindset, whatever everyone thinks is right must be. Moral relativism differs from moral pluralism, a more contemporary and universal view of relativism. Moral pluralism acknowledges the coexistence of opposing ideas and practices, but accepts limits to differences, such as when vital human needs get violated. It is very progressive to acknowledge the coexistence of opposing ideas and practices, and very progressive to accept limits to differences. Compromise is a form of relativism, as opposed to an absolute approach to life. In fact, accepting of others' people's values and agreeing that there is no one right way of doing some things really has little to do with the philosophical idea of relativism. It's more to do with survival in a society, making a family work as a unit, thriving inside a relationship. Further, relativism does not necessarily imply tolerance, just as moral objectivism does not imply intolerance. We need to reject these simplistic tools, these simplistic labels, with their implied prefab meanings. Remember, if everybody's right, then no one is wrong. Otherwise, we could say that all beliefs, ideas, and truths are equally valid, or just as well say that all beliefs are equally worthless. Whatever. For me, moral relativism and its consequences, uncertainty, can undermine our confidence in how we see morality, resulting in a breakdown of norms and values. Complete social Darwinism follows, the survival of the fittest. You can see this within a society, but also within a family, a marriage, a friendship, or a job. The principles of social justice are ignored, violating some of the very basic concepts of pluralism and social justice. We have seen for the last 50 years the call for social Darwinism in American politics, ironically supported by the very poor, the less educated, the disenfranchised, the religious fundamentalists, those most likely to be harmed by those very precepts of social Darwinism. In the extreme, relativism denies that harming others is wrong in any absolute sense. In general, progressives consider it immoral to harm others, but relativist theory allows for the opposite belief. If I can believe it is wrong for me to harm others, I can also believe it to be relatively right, no matter what the circumstances. Very few of us are willing to turn the other cheek when we or our most loved ones are being physically attacked, and neither should we. More than simple survival instincts, all life forms will react to protect themselves. Einstein witnessed the logical consequences of moral relativism and the form of the widespread popular support by German citizens for the Nazi movement and of communism under Stalin and Mao. Theoretical arguments on moral relativism ignore or overlook reality. As Einstein said, reality is merely an illusion, albeit a very persistent one. Einstein also said, we should take care not to make the intellect our God. It has, of course, powerful muscles, but no personality. In this way, Einstein was cautioning us against following dispassionate logic and adopting absolutist principles in our own lives. Yet, Einstein adopted his intellect as his personal God. But what if God did play dice with the universe? There are several predictable results. First, of course, not everything would be knowable. Second, mystery could be acceptable, as it should be. And thirdly, unfortunately, situational ethics could be acceptable. So how does all this relate to us? As moral citizens, we see in general that truth, ethical, moral, and theologic truths are relative and situational, not absolute. Truth, as distinguished from scientific facts, is found in all religions, not just Bible-based Christianity and Judaism. And truth, not being fact, by its very subjective nature, is quite relative. We can therefore embrace a range of truths and an open set of beliefs. True, we can hold a few absolute principles and ideas that guide us as a movement and as a tradition. We have overwhelmingly tended to see life, morality, and truth as finely nuanced, complex, and relative things that are generally do not respond well to absolute laws, rules that don't change, or inflexible statements. Who is least able to function in society, in the workplace, in a relationship, than the absolutist? My own worldview is that our creations and everything, both natural and human within it, are very complex matters. They are marked not so much by simplicity and clarity, but by complexity and subtlety. It would be nice and reassuring if life and truth and morality came to us in straightforward and absolute clarity. It usually does not. Because of the incredible intricacy, complexity, and changeability of life, and of being a thinking, caring person and members of society. Centuries ago, Isaac Newton and other early scientists first postulated the basic laws of physics and the other natural sciences. Then, the scientific community thought it had identified forces and mechanisms like gravity and the velocity of things like light and sound that were absolutes. Science became, for some, the new religion. In the following centuries, science has evolved and matured with the findings of Darwin, Einstein, Heisenberg, Hubble, Watson, and Crick. Scientists have realized that the once apparently clear and immutable laws of truth and laws that had been identified are, in fact, often imprecise and mysterious, not fully understood, subject to change, vulnerable to cultural bias, and dependent upon each context in which they operate. Most scientists today hesitate to make absolute statements about the laws of the natural world. Scientists see the world in increasingly relativistic terms, depending on their context, and so should we. This is Donald Marks, continuing my discussion of Einstein, relativity, and relative ethics. How is the dice analogy important? If we now can understand a great deal of scientific truth to be relative and contextual, how much easier is it to see how truth is also relative in the human and moral realms we live in? In my professional world of healthcare, simple answers often don't exist. Absolute statements don't always work, and eternal truths are hard to come by. Life itself often seems to be a collection of factors which change based upon floating circumstances. We cannot know and control everything, and perhaps we should accept this and just be at peace. What is the best way to live ethically and morally with one another? I know many people try. Some manage to persuade themselves and others that they alone have all the answers. I have found in my own life that most moral and human issues defy absolute answers. What makes something just? How will it work? Who will decide? And how will we know when we truly, once and for all, achieve real or pure or absolute justice? Only an absolutist can answer these questions. Let's look at another human characteristic everybody believes in and wants to understand: love. Everybody says that love is good, but does anyone know precisely, in all human contexts, situations, and relationships, what absolute love looks like? We may think we know something about what love often feels like or looks like in our lives, and there is lots of poetry that attempts to describe it. Take, for example, "Love Is Not All" by Edna St. Vincent Millay, which I read in another podcast, in my podcast episodes. But we do really know with absolute certainty what love is, do we? Sometimes love needs to wear a face that is almost totally counterintuitive. Many parents have had to love their out-of-control children by sending them off to tough love boot camps, or even not interfering with their going to prison as a way of loving and protecting and serving all parties. Sometimes also love means withholding gentleness and affirmation, or fiercely restraining individuals from doing what they want so that they don't hurt themselves or others. What is real and pure love? Who among us can be sure we are in any given complex human situation or relationship expressing love? Many of us have the gift to feel it. Pity those who cannot. There are many moral absolutists in this country who declare themselves to be pro-life, which means to them that they, by their actions, are staunch and righteous defenders of human life. Pro-life with respect to abortion, pro-death as it applies to the death penalty. Their opposites are labeled pro-choice. In effect, the pro-choice have been unwillingly transformed into being anti-life, but I think that those who are pro-life have done so out of their own choice, and therefore they are pro-choice, not anti-life. The pro-life are therefore pro-choice. Similarly, those who are pro-choice do so because they feel deeply that this is how they can most honor their innermost beliefs to save and protect life. So are they not pro-choice, simultaneously pro-life? I detest the terms pro-life and pro-choice, which misrepresent their component positions. Space and time become space-time. Matter changes into energy, becomes antimatter, and then back again. We love, become indifferent, are consumed by hate, turn cold, and then die. We can see how pro-life and pro-choice are relative labels, but their consequences absolutely do matter. Most morally absolutist positions are not reasonable. This is because the reality of life and existence comes to us in a context that is mostly relative, with lots of uncertainty. The relativity in most human relationships is something that the absolutist truth cannot handle. We must struggle in our lives and in this complex world of ours to seek truth and goodness and moral responsibility. In our lives, we must almost always recognize the situational and not absolute. We cannot know simultaneously the position of our hearts and the energy of our beliefs, but we can live with the uncertainty because we must. Yet, I think that we can all agree on moral, ethical situations for which an absolute yes or no can arise. Let us consider the biblical story of Sodom and Gomorrah. Forced sexual assault by a mob of men on two visiting men, or a father offering his daughters to the very mob of men as an appeasement to their bizarre, violent sexual lust, and the complete destruction of a city because of its moral failure of some of its citizens are all examples where one can easily say, no, I do not agree. None of this is acceptable. Neither are honor killings, spousal abuse, and thousands of other examples. We do have moral absolutes. And so I arrive at the core of my arguments. If we are to be fully human and humane, we must regularly use our reason and our conscience and our freedom in every situation ethic we face. Conservative, legalistic, and absolutist thinkers suggest that to take a relative approach to truth in each situation is somehow equated with having no moral standards or principles at all. Nothing could be farther from the truth. Both a relativistic and an absolutist finally arrive at a firm moral decision making point, and both act on principle and with purpose. The difference is simply how they get there, what moral methods they use to get to what is right, how many aspects of each problem they are willing to consider, and whether they are afraid of human freedom and reason or embrace them. Absolutist thinking only requires that you know what the law is and then precisely follow its dictates. Situational or relative thinking, on the other hand, requires that you articulate first principles for your living and then struggle to serve those first principles as best you can in the messy mix of real situational life. If I am right that truth in this complex world of ours is almost always relative and subject to the situation, then you and I, as responsible citizens, have a lot of work to do as we strive in our daily lives to live the path of love and right. The fact that truth and morality are relative means that we are obliged in our ethical and interactive lives to struggle with life's shifting complexities, contradictions, and uncertainties, to do the hard work of trying to discern what is right and good in each particular life situation, to weigh in our hearts and minds the values and principles which demand our allegiance, yet often come into conflict with one another. We must then act almost always without complete certainty if we are honest with ourselves, but yet with clarity of purpose and principle as we are given to see them. Is doing the hard work of considering life's relativities scary? Absolutely. Is there room for error? Yes. Every day and all the time. But in a world like ours, in the end, we have no choice. Legalistic absolutes almost never work in the real world. Principled relativism and moral pluralism alone can best serve us as we stumble towards that which is good and loving and right. We are human beings obliged by a messy and uncertain world to use our freedom, our reason, and our first principles situationally, relativistically, every day. I do not believe this world gives us any other choice. We simply must use reason and freedom and be as fully and bravely human as we can. So the answer is that God, however we know God to be, does not play dice with the universe. All this is not a game. We are not pawns on some meaningless chessboard. God is not indifferent to our lives and our choices. What we do and how we relate are relatively important to ourselves, to our loved ones, and to our community. Of this, there is no uncertainty. Thank you for listening to the Existentialist podcast. I have many interesting podcasts available at this location on Spotify and on Google Podcast. The text for these podcasts and all my other writings, both non-medical and medical, are available on my blog, dhmarks.blogspot.com. Let me know your feedback, your comments, suggestions, and corrections.